If you've ever been to a wedding, either as a participant or simply as a guest, simply as an onlooker, I wonder if you've ever sat there and thought, this is an act of subversion. Weddings are an act of rebellion, an act of undermining the prevalent authority of the time and undermining of the prevalent mood of the time. And no, I am not talking about people who run away to elope and marry despite the objections of their friends and family. I'm talking much more broadly. I'm talking about how weddings undermine oppression, undermine the constraints of government and society and all that might be placed upon them. Now, I guess you might argue that a couple who elope are doing just that. They're undermining the authority of their family. But whether it is a couple eloping or a couple surrounded by family and friends, for the couple, for the guests, for the families and friends who act as witnesses of the celebration, for those who simply are walking by and just see people emerge from a town hall or a church and stop and look, weddings are a public act of subversion, because when a wedding takes place, wherever you find a wedding takes place, you find optimism, hope, expectation. Now, before you object, before you say anything, I know the reality of that hope and is not always fulfilled. I know it is with sadness that for some people, marriage itself is never actually fulfilled. It's an unfulfilled dream. And they have to live with being single. I know for some, the hope and expectation that children will come with marriage is left unfulfilled. And I know that marriages fail. And they fail for all sorts of reasons. And in doing so, the expectations not only of the couple but of their friends and families are dashed. And I know that some weddings do not have that sense of hope and expectation because they are marriages of convenience. But despite all this, if ever you go to a wedding, whether it is as a participant or simply an onlooker, or maybe just standing and watching a couple emerge from a town hall or from a church building, standing for photos, confetti in the air, you can't help but be swept up by the hope and the expectation that the ceremony exudes. Which is why when weddings are cancelled, when one member of the couple fails to show up, when we are told by the government that weddings cannot take place for fear of the spread of a virus, then we are stripped from something. Even if we have no intention of getting married, even if there's no immediate expectation of a ceremony that we're going to be invited to attend, the suspension of the wedding ceremony strips us of something, which is why this passage in Jeremiah 7 is so sad. When the Lord says, I will bring to an end a sound of joy and of gladness, and the voice of the bride and the bridegroom in the towns of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem will become desolate. Which is why at the onset of the pandemic, when the government said, only two people could gather, we couldn't do weddings anymore. Because in this country, you need five people for a wedding to take place. The couple themselves, the two witnesses, and a registrar or authorized person. And so when only two people can meet together, you can't have a wedding. And so something was taken from us on that day. Something about hope, something about expectation, something about was removed from our experience, and not just for those who were planning weddings, which is what makes the wedding in Cana interesting. Because the wedding in Cana is a subversive act. But before we get to that, Jeremiah 7 is not our lectionary passage for today. Only Isaiah 62 is, and only John chapter 2 is the wedding in Cana are. Both these passages are in the lectionary for today. Both speak of weddings in a very positive way. Indeed, in a subversive way. In John 2, we find Jesus on the verge of his ministry. He's called his disciples, and they've set off on their journey on their adventure. And the first place they go is to a wedding that is taking place under Roman rule. A wedding that is taking place in a nation that is overseen by a foreign power, a foreign empire. Foreign troops enforce the law. Foreign troops collect taxes, not for the behalf of Israel, but for Rome and the expense of an empire. And yet here, in the midst of all the difficulties, a wedding takes place. Even here, there are hope, signs of hope and expectation. Is it any wonder that Jesus' first move when he's called his disciples, according to John, is they go to a wedding. And they go to a wedding because it is this subversive act. There is hope and expectation. There is rejoicing in the midst of oppression. Bearing in mind the subversive nature of weddings, is it any wonder... I'm so excited with this, I get lost. Weddings are such a subversive act because they bring with them hope. And so we see it right at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry. Hope and expectation. It's why John concludes with the story. What Jesus did here at Cana in Galilee was the first of his signs through which he would reveal his glory. The first sign is to turn up to an event that has with it hope, expectation, and is an act of subversion, an act of undermining the power of an oppressive regime. Attending a wedding and blessing the gathering by helping its host deal with a difficult situation, an embarrassing situation, we're running out of wine. Jesus brings hope and expectation. There's a hope that things might change, and even more, a hope and an expectation that Jesus might just pull it off, that actually things might just change, and that Jesus might actually be who the people of God, the people of Israel, have been waiting for. The underlying story of the wedding in Cana is one of subversion, of undermining, of bringing about change, a fresh anticipation of what God might do. And they're going to celebrate it. The passage in Isaiah 62 is equally hopeful, equally filled with expectation, equally subversive. But ironically, it comes before Jeremiah 7. It comes before that time of speaking of desolation, of the piling up of bodies and of no weddings, of the lack of celebration. Whereas Jeremiah comes in the midst of a turmoil and the tragedy of exile, the wrenching of our people from their own land and their carrying off and the imprisoning and the forced labor in a foreign land, Isaiah tends to look forward to this. It predates this. But here in Isaiah 62, we see Isaiah looking forward to what will come beyond Jeremiah's experience. And we find something else. We find hope, expectation, a hope of celebration again, a hope of weddings again. But we find something more. As well as being a subversive act, as well as the hope and the expectation, we find a sign of commitment. If ever you've been to a wedding in the UK, you will have witnessed the couple making promises. Promises to be faithful, promises to stick with each other through good times and the more difficult times. And some of these promises, whilst they might be made, might be slightly different in the way they're framed in England and Scotland. And no, I haven't done a wedding in either Wales or Northern Ireland yet, so I can't tell you about that. But in Scotland and England, they are slightly different. The principles are the same. The principles are laid down in law, which makes the promise that is made at a wedding a covenant agreement, a legally binding agreement. In many ways, a joyous covenant. A covenant made in the context of a happy event. And that's what's going on in Isaiah 62. Now, bear in mind the timeline of Israel's history. This is before everything falls apart and Israel are taken into exile. This is, some of Isaiah warns of this, but this speaks about what's coming after. This comes before there are no more weddings, comes before the time when the hope and expectation is stripped from Israel, and that's why it's a prophetic passage. That's why it speaks to what is yet to come, a time of restoration after all that Jeremiah will say and experience in many ways. This acts as a reminder of the God who is faithful to his people, even when they are unfaithful to him. This is something about the commitment that God makes to his people, even though there are times when he must speak harshly to them. Look at verse 4 in Isaiah 62. It says, "No longer will they be called deserted or their name desolate. But you will be called Hephzibah, and your land Beulah. For the Lord will take great delight in you, and your land will be married." Your land will be married. Hephzibah means my delight is in her. Beulah means married. Twice in the same verse, God speaks of being wedded to his people. The Lord has given them a covenantal promise. But it raises a question for me. When we speak of a God who promises to never leave us or forsake us, I wonder when the tough going gets tough and there are no more weddings, there are no more events that remind us of the joyous occasions that life brings, when there are no signs of hope and expectation, no reminders of God's presence, I wonder how seriously we take the promise that comes first in Deuteronomy 3, verses 6 and 8, the promise that God will never forsake us or never leave us, a promise that resurfaces in a different way in Isaiah 62. I wonder how seriously we take that belief, hold on to it. Remember that it is a covenantal, a legally binding contract between God and his people that he will never leave them or forsake them. And not only that, we'll vindicate them. Now, to understand the whole vindication thing, we have to appreciate the accusations that are being made against Israel at the time of their exile. You know, when you look at it, they've been overcome military. They've lost a war. They've been carried away to forced labor in a foreign land. Jerusalem has been sacked. All the gold and silver have been taken from the temple and carried away as booty of war. Everything has gone wrong for them. And it's easy to see why the nations would stand and point a finger and say, "Where is your God now? Has your God abandoned you? Has he deserted you?" He's not much of a God, is he, if he doesn't stand up for you in the times that are most difficult. Where is your God? And yet the Lord says, even before all this even happens, before these accusations are even made, For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent. For Jerusalem's sake, I will not remain quiet till her vindication shines like the dawn, her salvation like a blazing torch. The nations will see your vindication and kings your glory. There might be times when the Lord is silent. There might be times when he is distant. But in that silence, that distance will not last forever. And that silence is not a sign that the Lord has given up on his people. Yes, of course it might be a sign he's upset with them. Yes, of course it might be a sign that he needs to discipline his people to bring them back in focus with him. In the case of Israel, it involves them being carried off into exile. But the Lord has not forgotten his people. There's coming a time when the Lord will break his silence in word and in action, and he will show his commitment to his people. That marriage act, that promise, that hope, that expectation, signed in a covenantal agreement, a legally binding contract that he has voluntarily committed himself to. A relationship with his people and the land they inhabit. Eventually, he will break that silence and clear his people's name and the suspicion that surrounds them that he, their God, has deserted them. With this in mind, I wonder whether this doesn't give us something to hold on to. When the world is falling apart and our hopes and our expectations seem to be crumbling before our eyes, I wonder if a promise like this, a promise that there will be a day of vindication, a day when our refusing to believe that God has given up on us will pay dividends. A day when we will be acknowledged by our God. And being acknowledged will be publicly revealed. And we will see revealed the love and the faithfulness of our God. When you look at it, there's much more to weddings than meet the eye. When you come and look at Jeremiah 7, when you look at Isaiah 62, when you look at John 2, and you bring them all together, there is more to a wedding ceremony than meets the eye. Because these three passages remind us of the hope and the expectation that's all tied up in a wedding. They remind us, and it should be no surprise to us, that the church is often referred to as the bride of Christ. Because it is in the church that God invests his hope and his expectation. Whatever sort of people we are, whatever problems we face, whatever failures or perceived failures we have, God invests in us. He invests his hope in us. He believes that however much we get it wrong, there are times when we get it just a tiny bit right, just enough that a bit more of his kingdom will become visible. A bit more of him will be showed to people who have their own doubts, their own questions. But it's not just hope, is it? Because just when a couple commit themselves to marriage, the promises they make are made in the expectation that the rest of their lives together will contain times of sickness, that there will be times of hardship. There may even be times of poverty. And so when the Lord takes on his church, the bride of Christ, he expects that they will not be perfect. There will be times when they get it wrong. There will be times when they make poor decisions and mess up. And there will be times when we are captivated by the ideas and practices that lead us away from God. Despite that, he commits himself to being with us anyway. And more than that, he expects there's going to be a time when his commitment to us is vindicated. When our names and his will be cleared, and there will be much rejoicing, much delight. Our God will delight in us, and we will delight in our God. And for these reasons, for the hope, the expectation, all that are tied up in a wedding, that makes the ceremony itself subversive, the celebration subversive, undermining. Because whether you experience a wedding as an onlooker, even when so many marriages fail, people still commit to them. During the pandemic, there was much disappointed because weddings were cancelled, because the outward celebration wasn't able to take place. People still commit to relationships with hope and with expectation. And the same thing applies to us in our relationship with God, our relationship as a church. While it's true that many people resist and reject the opportunity to live in a relationship with Jesus, while it's true that some people have begun this relationship and have given up for a host of reasons, there are still those who freely accept the invitation that God offers to come and follow Jesus. Which is why Christian faith is subversive. It undermines the cynical fabric of society that says there's no God. And if he is, even if there is, he's not interested in us. But more than that, there's hope and expectation. Weddings are a reminder of a commitment as well. And yes, I know that human beings' commitment, our commitment, often runs thin. But when you read the opening verses of Isaiah 62, when you go to a church and come and see a communion table with its bread and its cup, when you come and gaze on the symbol of a cross, we very quickly get the sense that while there might be times when we give up, God doesn't give up on us. He is committed to this relationship. He's committed, to use a card-playing term, he is all in. And I'm left wondering, are we all in to this relationship? Committed to walking in the pathway of Christian discipleship, of following in the footsteps of Jesus, of deepening our relationship with him? And I wonder what our hopes and expectations are of this relationship. Is there a hope and an expectation that our God will see us through the most difficult times, as well as the times of ease? And finally, I wonder if there is an act of subversion here. If we're committed to following in the footsteps of Jesus with hope and expectation invested in our God, a little bit more each day. I wonder what a relationship with God looks like and changes and becomes. Is there more commitment each day? Does it undermine the philosophy of our day? Is it filled with hope and expectation? And if the answer is no, at least not at the moment, I wonder whether that might change, whether there might be a day of vindication. Amen.